On ABC Radio National, hello from David Rutledge and welcome to Encounter. This week we're looking at the ism of Buddhism from the perspective of a distinguished scholar and author and occasional visitor to Australia. Buddhism is variously described as a religion, a philosophical system, an ethical code, a set of practices and so on. But none of these descriptions is really in line with what the Buddha taught. Or at least that's the view of Stephen Batchelor, a Buddhist writer and practitioner whose critical explorations of Buddhist texts and traditions have seen him hailed as a reformer and denounced as something of a heretic. Stephen Batchelor has been a Buddhist monk in the Tibetan and Zen traditions. He's the author of several books, including Buddhism Without Beliefs and Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist, and today he lives in France where he teaches and leads meditation retreats. Buddhism, as it's commonly perceived, centres around the Four Noble Truths. Life means suffering, the origin of suffering is attachment, the cessation of suffering is attainable, and the way to that attainment is provided by the Eightfold Path, which incorporates right view, right intention, right speech, right action, and so on. But there's a paradox inherent in the very concept of Buddhist truths. Buddhism teaches that everything is subject to change, and the implication of that is that all truths are relative. Whatever Buddhism says is true, and indeed whatever Buddhism itself can be said to be, is contingent and no more permanent than anything else in this world. And if this sort of thinking seems abstract or semantic, it can have very real bearing on how one lives and practices the teaching of the Buddha or Dharma. Well, Stephen Batchelor will be visiting Australia early next year, and I'll tell you more about that at the end of the program. But he was also in Sydney late last year at the invitation of the group Sydney Insight Meditators, and today we'll be hearing an edited version of the talk he gave.
I was recently, actually just over a week ago, I was in Budapest at a conference of the European Buddhist Union, which, as you can imagine, is a very widespread collective of different Buddhist groups right across the European continent. And because nowadays it's necessary for Buddhists to be represented at government and transnational levels, then Buddhists have to somehow account for themselves, to tell the wider public who on earth they are. And this often leads to meetings where you sit around for the best part of a day trying to define what it is you have in common that allows you to be able to say, I am a Buddhist. And that question is actually very difficult to answer. You can come up with all sorts of orthodox ideas. Well, Buddhists are people who believe in the Four Noble Truths. And almost invariably, you'll find someone in the room who says, well, actually, that doesn't quite apply in our case. It's a Japanese reform movement or something or other. And what that shows to me is that Buddhism, true to its own understanding of the world, is not reducible to some fixed essential core, any more than when one analyzes in meditation or through philosophy what constitutes the essential nature of oneself, which is, of course, a big issue in many Buddhist traditions. So, in this respect, I think we have to drop the idea that we're ever going to come to a final, definitive account of what Buddhism is. It is somehow too diverse to be readily reduced to some particular idea or meditation practice. It includes all of those things, but as they say in Gestalt psychology, it's more than the sum of its parts. Buddhism, therefore, as something that has now been with us on planet Earth for the last 2,500 years, is constantly, rather like an organism, adapting to different situations, is meeting the needs of different people and different cultures at different times. And as it moves through history, it mutates. It evolves. Different elements of the Dharma become more prominent in some cultures and less prominent in others. One of the really striking things in a country like Australia or Europe or America, in particular, countries that are not traditionally Buddhist countries, is that suddenly, and this really began in the 1960s and 1970s, we find ourselves exposed to a bewildering variety of forms, so diverse, in fact, that were we, say, to take a Tibetan Lama, let's say, of the Nyingma school, a Sri Lankan bhikkhu, and, let's say, a priest of a Pure Land tradition in Japan, and ask them what Buddhism is, going back to our original question, we might be quite hard-pressed to recognize that they were actually of the same broad tradition. And in fact, this happened in the period beginning in about the 17th century, when the first Christian missionaries, mainly Jesuits, went to India and then on to Japan and China and Tibet. They did not recognize that these different variants of what today we'd call Buddhism were actually belonging to the same tradition at all. They assumed that what was going on in Tibet was some local regional religion of Tibetans. What was going on in Japanese Zen monasteries was some Japanese folk cult or something. It took until about the end of the 18th century before they twigged that this tradition actually was one thing. Now today we no longer think that way, but nonetheless we are confronted with another set of questions that come up particularly if we're drawn to Buddhist ideas. We might have seen the Dalai Lama on the TV or something, read a couple of introductory books on Buddhism, find it rather appealing, want to know more about it. And yet when we find ourselves in a direct encounter with a traditional form of Buddhism, we'll often find that that particular type does not really recognize much other than its own forms, its own traditions, its own teachings, and its own views. It's quite strange in a way, I find, that many Buddhists, Western Buddhists, are actually often not very interested in other forms of Buddhism. They often become quite committed to the idea that the particular school within which they are practicing, to which they belong, is what the Dharma really is. In other words, they somehow follow the rhetoric of the tradition itself and have little interest in what is going on elsewhere. But I don't think that's a particularly sustainable situation. I feel that the diversity and complexity of Buddhism is in fact one of its greatest richnesses. The differences are not a problem, do not necessarily have to be divisive, but in fact they can be seen as a source of celebration. The fact that this broad tradition called Buddhism is able to generate such a wide range of forms is, I think, a sign of its vitality. What we also notice, if we look at this from an historical perspective, is that Buddhism has survived and has flourished precisely because it has the capacity to reimagine itself, to rethink itself, to present itself in a different way according to the needs of the particular people, the particular time, the culture in which it finds itself at a given time. Buddhism is very fluid in this sense. Unlike, say, religions that are very committed, say, to upholding the word of a single book, let's say the Quran or the Bible, Buddhists do not have a common canonical set of texts. Each tradition comes up with its own choice of what it considers canonical. Buddhism does not have, in contrast to some other traditions, a central authority, like the Pope or the Vatican or some kind of centralized church in England or somewhere else. But rather, each particular form of Buddhism that has come into being has done so in its own peculiar way that suits and is adapted to the particular situation of its historical background. Now this, of course, shouldn't be surprising from a Buddhist point of view. Buddhism makes the very oft-repeated assertion that all conditioned things are impermanent, all conditioned things are somehow imperfect, unsatisfactory, and all things are likewise without any essential identity. These are called the three marks of being: anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness or suffering or imperfection, dukkha, and anatta, not self. There's nothing intrinsically or essentially true about them. But what is curious, at least what I find curious, is that Buddhism quite rarely, if ever, applies that way of looking at things to itself. In other words, all conditioned things are impermanent, except this particular school of Buddhism. All conditioned things are imperfect, except our church, etc.
On ABC Radio National, this is Encounter, and you're listening to Stephen Batchelor, author of Buddhism Without Beliefs.
In my own case, and I imagine this is probably the case with many of you, one starts one's practice at a particular point, with a particular school, with a particular teacher, and frankly, there's really no other way to do it. You can't just try and pick and choose from everything that is available that calls itself Buddhism. If you're going to commit yourself to this practice, you need to commit yourself to a particular way of doing it, a particular form, a particular teacher, a particular lineage. Otherwise, it's very difficult to make any progress at all. You're not held by a community, you don't have a consistent philosophy, you don't have a set of practices that you perform on a daily basis. In other words, you never manage really to achieve any depth in your practice. So even though you know that Buddhism is far wider than the particular school in which you're working, from a pragmatic point of view, you need to commit yourself to one bit of it. But at a certain point, in my own case, this was after having spent 7 years as a Tibetan Buddhist monk in the Gelug school, which is a rather scholarly approach, and also another 4 years in a Korean Zen monastery doing a very traditional Rinzai Zen training, it became very clear to me that I could not, in all honesty, identify myself with either of these schools. At the same time, though, I felt very strongly, in fact I would say rather passionately, a follower of the Buddha, a Buddhist. And so in some respects, I feel that my own life, and I've now been doing nothing but working within a Buddhist framework for the last 40 years nearly, my own life has become a kind of an experiment. And again, that's sometimes uncomfortable because I don't really sometimes know where my feet are standing, on what ground. But I think on balance, I find it very liberating. So my identity as a Buddhist is one that is drawn from my exposure to diverse schools. But of course, again, if we step back and look at Buddhism more historically, we find that that's pretty much always been the case. Most of the forms of Buddhism that we encounter today come from a diversity of sources. So diversity is not intrinsically a problem. What we are encountering, I feel, and I think this is probably true for many of us, is an inability to really feel comfortable and at home in any of the traditional Asian schools. And this may be the case also increasingly for Asian Buddhists themselves. I'm very uncomfortable with the word Western Buddhism. Geographically, of course, that's almost an absurdity in Australia. But I feel that what is going on now, as much in Asia as in the so-called West, is a confrontation of between Buddhism and what we might loosely call modernity. This is a product, to some extent, of globalization, of the availability of teachings, of practices, of teachers from all different traditions all over the world now. When I lived in Korea, this was in the early 1980s, Korea was still recovering from the trauma of the Korean War. The country was being rebuilt. Koreans did not have much freedom to travel outside their borders. Korean Buddhist monks, likewise, were pretty much confined to their monasteries. But through Korea having become, with extraordinary rapidity, a modern industrial power, with a very fine Western-influenced education system, a participant in the global economy and in the world culture. Nowadays, there are many Korean Buddhist monks and nuns who travel abroad. They go and do Vipassana retreats in India. They go and study with Tibetan monks. And we see, therefore, that this process of encountering Buddhism as something increasingly diverse is occurring in Asia as well. It's not no longer just a thing about Western Buddhism. I think that word has to be abandoned. It's not helpful anymore. We're coming, I think, into a very new kind of Buddhist culture, a kind of a global culture. And nobody has a clue where this is going to go and how it's going to shake out. I certainly don't. I suppose, though, what in recent years, pretty much ever since I came back from the East, what I've become more and more interested in is exploring the origins of the Buddhist tradition and asking myself the question, what is it that the Buddha himself, this man Siddhartha Gautama, actually might have said? And the more I go into these early texts that fortunately, have been translated many times now into English, the Pali Canon, I begin to discover that much of what we find coming from the Buddha's own mouth is often at odds with Buddhism. Let me give you an example of that. One of the stock passages that you find in the Pali Canon concerns the Buddha's refusal to answer certain questions that we would call metaphysical questions. Does the world have a beginning? Does it have an end? Is the universe finite? Is it infinite? Are mind and body the same? Or are mind and body two separate things? Does one exist after death? Does one not exist after death? Or both, or neither. And whenever the Buddha was presented these kinds of questions, or asked these questions, he wouldn't give an answer. All he would say was, to explore such kinds of questions is not conducive to the path that I teach. And the point is not to pursue these kinds of questions in the hope that Buddhism will answer them for us, but actually to simply not pursue them and to recognize that what really is important is not having a correct description of the state of affairs in reality, but what matters is doing something that might make a real difference in the quality of your life here and now. And this is usually the context within which these questions are placed. The most famous one is the parable of the arrow. The Buddha says, imagine there's a man who's been shot by a poisoned arrow. He's lying on the ground. He's in great pain. His friends bring a doctor to help him recover from this poisoned arrow. And the man says, no, I won't let you take this arrow out of my body until I know the name and the clan and the village where this person was born, what the color of his skin was, and so forth and so on. And the Buddha says, likewise, if you will not put into practice my teaching until you know whether the mind and the body are the same or different, whether you exist after death or not, you will keep on pursuing these questions, and just like the man with the arrow, you'll end up dead. The priority is to remove the arrow, to find a means whereby to actually change the painful situation in which you may find yourself. Now, by contrast, pretty much every school of Buddhism has come up with answers to these questions. Maybe not so much the ones about the universe, which are not quite so important, but the idea of whether the mind and the body are the same or different, pretty much every orthodox Buddhist school today will maintain that they're different. And the reason they will do that is because if you don't make that distinction, you can't account for reincarnation. You have to assume, if you are going to get reborn, that there is something that will not decay and disintegrate and end at physical death. In other words, you need to assume a mind-body dualism. In spite of the fact, therefore, that the Buddha said, don't go there, Buddhists went there in spades. The same, of course, about whether one is born or not born again after death. The Buddha says, don't go there, but Buddhists are very much in the business of going there. Not only doctrinally and philosophically, which is the case, was very much the case in my Tibetan tradition, but also economically. When I lived in Korea, and in Zen Buddhism, there's really not much emphasis on metaphysical belief. In fact, Zen rather prides itself on not getting too bogged down in concepts and ideas. Nonetheless, when one of the lay supporters of the monastery dies, we had to spend a lot of time chanting the Diamond Sutra and all sorts of other texts in order to assure this person of a good rebirth. And in fact, one of the primary sources of income for Buddhist monasteries in Asia is the death industry. It becomes necessary to support the financial running of the center of the monastery. So we find that Buddhism, I feel, in many ways betrays the whole approach that was laid down by the Buddha. And I think the same is true also with some of its most primary doctrines, particularly the doctrine of the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths is often presented as the kind of the core doctrine of Buddhism, and it's a good candidate, let's say, for a kind of this is the essence of Buddhism definition. But the way in which the Four Noble Truths are presented are basically as a set of four propositions you are expected to believe. The first one is that life is suffering. The second, that the origin of suffering is craving. The third, that there is the possibility of the cessation of suffering. And the fourth truth is to believe that the Eightfold Noble Path will lead you to the cessation of suffering. In other words, these are four metaphysical propositions once again. Yet when you look at the first sermon, in which the Buddha introduces these four truths for the first time, it's quite clear that the emphasis he gives lies in the fact that each of these truths is actually a task to be recognized, performed, and accomplished. It's a very different view of truth. In fact, I would argue that the Buddha is really the first pragmatist, in the sense of William James and more recently Richard Rorty, that what is true is not what corresponds to some state of affairs in the world, but what is true is what actually works and helps and leads to concrete benefits in human life. The Four Noble Truths looked at in this way are not a description of reality, but are a prescription, an instruction or an encouragement to do something, not to believe something. Religions, though, of course, are all in the business of belief. And that's what gives them their certitudes. It's what gives them their authority, because these are doctrines or orthodoxies that actually have access to the truth. It's striking, actually, how the Buddha never uses the word truth in that way. He never talks about the truth. And this is a tendency that runs through pretty much all of his teaching, as we find it in these early texts. He's concerned quite consistently with doing something that makes a palpable and discernible difference in the quality of human life, both individually and communally, rather than advancing a theory that one then has to somehow persuade others of being the truth. But I think if we are to arrive at a secular Dharma, at a practice and an understanding of what the Buddha taught, that speaks to the condition of our times, I feel that we have to very much put into question some of the prevailing orthodoxies that have been inherited from the traditional schools of Buddhism in Asia. One way to do this is to try to go back as close as we can to what the Buddha himself might have said and might have done. And we are greatly advantaged in this process because of the work of modern scholarship. We're able now to get a much clearer historical sense of which texts are earlier and which texts are later. But at the same time, we have to be true also to the fact that the Dharma is something that you do, that a teaching or an idea or a practice is only really of value if it works, if it actually makes a difference in your life, if it actually can enable us and provide us with a vision of what a human being could be. Namo Rengaka, Namo Rengaka,
Namo Rengaka. Buddhist scholar and author Stephen Batchelor speaking in Australia on the secular Dharma. This is Encounter, and you're listening to it on ABC Radio National. Namo Rengaka, Namo Rengaka, Namo Rengaka. Well, Stephen Batchelor's talk was followed by questions from the audience. The first had to do with reincarnation and the curious fact that the Buddha himself, while on the one hand advising that we should avoid getting too caught up in questions of metaphysics and ultimate truth, nevertheless appears to have had a lot to say about reincarnation, which is a decidedly metaphysical concept. Stephen Batchelor.
If you pick up the Pali Canon at random and start reading it, you'll soon come across passages where the Buddha seems to be assuming, really, the existence of reincarnation. Now, what you don't find is that I can't think of a single text in the Pali Canon where the Buddha says, okay, reincarnation, this is what it means. Never. It's always assumed. It's never actually described. The Buddha never once gives any mechanism whereby it might happen. He never describes any kind of consciousness or bhavanga citta, which is the term the later Theravadins came up with to explain what it was that went from life to life. Those passages have to be seen in the context of the Buddha's time. The doctrine of rebirth, the doctrine of karma as the kind of law of moral cause and effect, all of this was in place prior to the Buddha himself. The basic soteriology, which is a fancy word for the way we think about salvation or liberation, in ancient India assumed that we were caught in a cycle of birth and death, driven usually by karma, K-A-M-A, and a desire, attachment, craving, which led to actions that cause us to get reborn. And this was dukkha and suffering. And the aim of the ascetic practice, or the Buddhist practice, was to break free from this cycle. So the Buddhist teachings, likewise, were presented in certain circumstances as another strategy to achieve the goals of Indian religious behavior. So in other words, the doctrine of rebirth has to be seen as part of the environment of the Buddha's time. The other way I'd look at it is to bear in mind that the Buddha was not a teacher, I think, who had a kind of a doctrinal model that he sought to impose equally on every teaching situation he found himself in. The Buddha was rather like Socrates. His teaching was always given in a dialogical context. In other words, every teaching was a response to a question that came from a particular person in a particular time of their life with particular issues that the Buddha was asked to respond to. And sometimes he would use the ideas of rebirth and so on, at other times he wouldn't. We do find texts, admittedly not many, where the Buddha throws into question the whole idea of rebirth and karma. That we find in the Kalama Sutta. So in other words, I think we have to be more clear about the assumptions we bring to the understanding of these texts, and to be able to start differentiating different styles of teaching, different contexts and occasions of teaching, in order to get a sense of how the Buddha responded to situations, which was pragmatic, I feel, and quite individual, rather than thinking that the Buddha had a kind of a worked out theory of whatever that was to be somehow imposed in a one-size-fits-all manner in every time that he opened his mouth. You see, I think I said at the beginning of my talk that the Buddha was the first process philosopher. He's interested in how things work, how by performing certain actions you generate certain effects. He's not interested in coming up with the definitive description of reality. This, I think, is a big problem. We need to think of Buddhism as a process, both individually, in terms of the unfolding of our own life from moment to moment and day to day. This is why I was saying you can't define Buddhism. There's no essence to it. It is like a wave, a modulation. And when it impacts with other systems, other wave systems like Chinese culture, let's say, then the interaction of the two generates what we call Chinese Buddhism. And this, of course, is utterly in tune with the primary ideas of the Buddha himself. Everything is changing, everything is conditional, everything's contingent, everything's imperfect, nothing has any essence. Buddhism too. In fact, perhaps the very word Buddhism, unfortunately, suggests something fixed, an ism. There is no equivalent in any Asian language to the word Buddhism. It's a Western invention. The Buddha Dharma is much better. Because it's, again, Dharma suggests law, not necessarily process, but certainly something that's not an ism, a fixed set of doctrines. Although many Buddhist traditions, in a sense, try to fit some kind of definition. They want there to be an orthodoxy because that underpins authority. It's always this tension between the two. I would actually question another dogma of Buddhism, and that is that Buddhism is about, has its goal of being the cessation of suffering, or the alleviation of pain. I don't think that's the goal of Buddhism. I think this business of the stopping of suffering is a vestige or a hangover from the classical Indian religious aim of achieving liberation from the cycle of birth and death, in other words, the cessation of suffering. It's not an exclusively Buddhist thing at all. Arguably all traditions are about the ending of suffering. Christianity, Islam, if you do good and you get, after you die, you go to heaven, it's the end of suffering. Is that Buddhism? Well, obviously not. Again, going back to the text, the Buddha's talking not about achieving a particular goal, he's talking about how we can live in this world in a way in which our lives flourish in all aspects. And that starts not with getting rid of suffering, but embracing suffering, by opening our minds and our hearts to the reality of suffering. That is the basic emphasis, I think, in Buddhist meditation. The importance of suffering lies in the fact that it's the starting point for a deep personal transformation in how we relate to ourselves and the world. And now here I'll cite a non-Pali text for a change. Shantideva, 8th century Mahayana Indian Buddhist monk. He says, if the Buddha identifies with the suffering of all beings, then how can he possibly be happy? How can he possibly experience joy? If he has this empathetic openness and identification with the world, with the suffering world. It's a very different picture to this idea of getting out of birth and death, getting into this blissful nibbanic state, being permanently happy with a great big smile on your face. And I think the current emphasis or interest in Buddhism, because it's the happiness religion, I think is also a big mistake. It fits our indulgent, hedonistic, Western preferences if happiness becomes the goal. I don't think happiness is the goal. No, I think the starting point for the Buddha is opening your mind and your heart to dukkha, to pain, and not shying away from it, and becoming more and more conscious of how you relate to it, how much of your behavior is basically a reactive denial of suffering. It's a movement away from, rather than a movement towards. And if we don't start there, then I think our practice will largely become rather self-indulgent.
Buddhist author Stephen Batchelor taking questions during his talk on the secular Dharma in Sydney. Another question from the audience had to do with the objective authority of Buddhist teaching as a way of describing the world.
I do feel that Buddhist authority, the authority in Buddhism is not the kind of authority we would look for, let's say, in science. Because Buddhism as a practice, as a spiritual practice, is not concerned with objectivity. It's concerned with subjectivity. And this is perhaps what marks it out as religious, is that it is concerned with the subject. It's concerned with things that cannot be measured in any kind of objective way. And again, I'm dubious, I'm uncomfortable, let's say, with the idea that, you know, if you can read the brain patterns accurately enough, you can find out which pattern corresponds to enlightenment. I'm very dubious about that. I think that approach is highly questionable. And I think one should be careful not to reduce Buddhism to a kind of technology. One of the problems in the West is we tend to think that Buddhist meditation is a technique without really registering the implications we have when we use the word technique. In other words, technique is very much a language of technology. In German, it's clearer, das Technik. Technique. And I was very influenced by Heidegger's work on this. I mean, his awareness of how the Western or the modern mind is somehow enframed within the paradigm of technology. And Buddhism, I'm afraid, can easily be sucked into that. And sometimes I'm afraid Buddhists almost reinforce that view. And they like to present Buddhism as an effective technique for reducing suffering. You've got a problem? Okay, here's a technique, it's called meditation, and it's very effective. You do it right, you'll get rid of suffering. That, I think, is again reducing Buddhism to a technological strategy, a kind of a self-help process that has almost claims to have a kind of quasi-scientific reliability. If you go through these steps of the path, you are guaranteed to end up wise and compassionate. I don't believe that. I think you can master all the techniques of meditation and remain just as screwed up as you were before you started. So authority, I feel, has to lie within a spiritual religious approach to life as one that is beyond the reach of objective assessment. We have to acknowledge that authority needs to come from experience. But that experience in Buddhist tradition is not an isolated private thing. It's something that is always embedded in social relations. One of the expressions I think that suggests this very strongly is when the Buddha describes his awakening. He says, this Dharma I have discovered is sensed by the wise. He uses this expression a lot, sensed by the wise, praised by the wise, condemned by the wise, which I take to understand that such an experience or insight somehow needs to be acknowledged and validated by human community, which has values of wise and foolish. It needs to somehow be registered, not just in your own private subjective experience, where, of course, as we all know, we're capable of endless self-deception and delusion. And there's all manner of people who run around saying, I'm enlightened, listen to me. And usually when somebody says that, my alarm bells ring very loudly. Very loudly. Because again, I think, you see, enlightenment has been reduced to an inner state. The description the Buddha gives of enlightenment, it's not reducible to a private inner state, some privileged consciousness in which you somehow gain access to the way the universe ticks, or the nature of reality, or the absolute, or mind, or God, or something. That's absolutely not what the Buddha says. Instead, he describes a process. He describes a way of being in the world. The Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, implies relationship, work, speech, acts. It's never a purely private experience. And yet Buddhism has tended, through its history, to reduce the experience of awakening or enlightenment to something purely private. So I think, yes, we do need to recognize and achieve, as it were, kind of subjective convictions, but they also need to be workable and functional and honored and acknowledged in the social world. Another term I think we really have to rethink is this word practice. Usually when you ask a Buddhist, what's your practice? I suspect people will name a spiritual exercise. Oh, my practice is Zen. My practice is insight meditation. My practice is Vajrayana Buddhism. That, I think, is reductive. The closest word we have in Pali or Sanskrit for practice is the word bhavana. In Tibetan, that's translated as gom, which does literally mean meditation, or is used to mean meditation. Bhavana in Theravada countries, likewise, has come now to mean meditation. In other words, the same thing has happened. The word practice has become reduced to doing specific spiritual exercises on a regular basis. And then you try to bring your practice into the world as a kind of a, you know, the next step. But the Buddha seems to have understood the word practice to embrace every aspect of the Fourth Noble Truth. So bhavana, since it applies to all eight aspects of the Eightfold Path, is far more than just doing some meditation exercise. The way you see the world, the way you think about it, the way you talk, the way you embody your actions in the world, the way you work, all of that is practice. So I wouldn't say that the discussion we're having now could not be practice. I think it is. I think it's the practice of, hopefully, right speech. I very much want to invest the word practice with far greater range than it currently has, So that, yes, my meditation in the morning is a practice, but also my work in the office is a practice. The way I communicate to my children is a practice. It's all practice. Life is practice. I don't mean that in a sort of glib, sort of superficial way at all. I think it's just as difficult, perhaps even more difficult sometimes, to speak truthfully, clearly, honestly, to think clearly, rationally, critically perhaps. I think the Buddha was a very good example of a critical thinker. He didn't suffer fools gladly, as we say. He could be very sharp and cutting at times. That was his practice. I mean, fortunately, my Tibetan tradition did emphasize that. You know, much of my training as a monk was not in meditation, it was in dialectics. It was in the study of logic, epistemology. And all of this was practiced. I remember a Mongolian lama called Geshen Awang Nyima. He was a wonderful old guy. And he taught our group of monks in Switzerland, where we had our monastery. And I remember once one of the monks said, Geshe-la, why do we have to do all this study? Why can't we practice? Why can't we do more practice? And the Geshe replied, if you really knew how to study, you would be practicing. And I think that was a very, very wise answer. And the teachers I most admire are the ones that I've been able to observe in all different sorts of human situations who have been just as present with other people, with some mundane task, as they have when they're doing some formal practice. And that's my aspiration as a Buddhist, is to actually turn my whole life into a practice. And not to differentiate, not to create a hierarchy of practices. Meditation is your real practice, and trying to be, speak nicely is a kind of an adjunct, a kind of optional extra that you have to do because you live in the world. I don't think so. The whole thing is practice. I think we'll start. That's a good point to start. Thank you very much.
On ABC Radio National, you've been listening to Encounter. This week, an encounter with Buddhist author and scholar Stephen Batchelor, who was in Australia in October last year at the invitation of Sydney Insight Meditators. What hasn't been mentioned during the course of the program is that Stephen Batchelor doesn't work alone. His wife, Martine Batchelor, is also an author and teacher, as well as a former Buddhist nun. And Stephen and Martine Batchelor will be visiting Australia together early in 2012 to run a series of discussions and workshops and retreats at various locations around the country. For information, go to the Encounter website at abc.net.au/rn/encounter, where you'll be able to find links to all the information you need. And as always, there'll be a transcript of today's program, as well as streaming audio and podcast links. And you can also leave a comment. We'd love to hear from you. Studio producer this week was Stephen Tilley, and I'm David Rutledge. Bye for now.